That beautiful day in Oregon, Salem, Oregon. This is April 16th, 2007. And I would like to, we're going to change the order. We will be doing Senate Bill 847 first, and then we're going to be doing Senate Bill 337 and 924 and 925 at the very end, just so that you understand that. Okay, with that, I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 847.
I'll go ahead and say a couple things, and then you guys can take over, okay?
Madam Chair, good morning, committee. This is I'm Brad Avakian, State Senator from District 17. Appreciate you very much holding a hearing on Senate Bill 847, which is a bill and an issue that is very close to my heart. The committee may not know, but before I was an attorney, I was a counselor, and also spent a good deal of time in the 90s chairing our state board of psychologist examiners. So these issues of mental health are something that are dear to me and very important to the state. And especially with regard to this population, about 13% of Oregonians are over the age of 65 right now, and it's expected in the next several decades that the number could double as our population of seniors increases. Statistics show that about 20% of seniors in Oregon right now have some diagnosable mental condition, and we are among the highest in the country on suicide rates for our seniors. And so we have a serious dilemma in Oregon, and this bill does something unique and necessary. In order to address the issue, it takes a look at the training that we give the mental health therapists in this state. Many are not trained both in their pre-licensure education or in their continuing education afterwards in geriatrics. And so what this bill does is it fills a void that we have in the state of Oregon right now by making sure that the pool of therapists we have in order to help these seniors are trained adequately. It's an important bill. I appreciate the committee's time this morning hearing it. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to hand it off to the real experts as I head back to my committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Avakian.
Good morning. My name is Robert Lawrence, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I, too, appreciate the fact that this important bill did get a hearing. I wish to thank a lot of people that got this bill to where it is today, particularly with Gina Nickel and Aaron Kelly Seal from the Governor's Office that have been very supportive in providing us with guidance. Also with Senator Gordley and her staff, and Senator Avakian and his staff, and the chair's staff. We understand that there are over 200 mental health bills, so to give this the opportunity for a hearing is very meaningful to us. You're very familiar with all of the data, and I don't need to hit you up with that again. I just personally would like to reflect on my development in this area since I retired. My interest in this field of mental health, geriatrics, started with a speech that was given to a group of people, talked about the Constitutional Party at Shampooey, and they had three priorities, which is transportation, which is obvious, security, and mental health. And that perked my interest. Dr. Dion and I were guests and speakers at a forum at Merrillhurst to talk about mental health issues in regard to geriatrics. And I found out at that time that Dr. Dion, although she looks like she's a lot younger than she actually is, had worked very closely with Dr. Davis in the 1980s. We also had an opportunity to talk to a roundtable of adult protective service people from Multnomah County and people that had been receiving SSI, Supplemental Security Income. And we learned a lot of interesting things. One of the things that the adult protective service workers told us about, they used to have a geriatric mental health worker who would go out on visits with them. That was cut because of funding. They also said that one of the things that is very important to them would be a guardianship conservatorship program that really stabilizes the situation. So the Governor's Commission has put all of these thoughts together, and our priorities have been Financial Abuse Coalition. We've been involved in the Everyday Heroes marketing campaign in regard to abuse and the Suicide Prevention Task Force. My formation is very indicative of what is happening out there in regards to the awareness of geriatric mental health. So the Governor's Commission has given this top priority, number one. And it actually addresses the needs of, it's not a standalone bill, Senate Bill 847, is really addressing the needs of family caregivers, preventing elder abuse, and addressing the mental health needs of all older adults. So we hope that we can pass this on, and if you pass this on to the Ways and Means, we will be very persistent and vigorous in our efforts to find funding. And now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Dion, and I understand Dr. Julie Jensen is on the telephone.
Yes.
She is?
Let's make that phone call now. Go ahead and introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair and committee members, thanks again for hearing our bill today. My name is Denise Dion. I am a general adult and geriatric psychiatrist. I'm going to be very brief in my
comments. Ready? Just a minute.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, Dr. Jensen?
Yes.
This is Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and
Hi.
We have Bob Lawrence and Dr. DeYoung, and she's going to make just a couple of preliminary remarks, and then we'd love to have some testimony from you.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Excuse me just a minute. We are passing out some material, and it's for reference for you so that if you have any questions later on, but Dr. Dion and Dr. Jensen will be discussing this. We also have her written testimony that's being passed out, too. So thank you.
Thank you.
I would really like to give Dr. Jensen as much time as possible. I will emphasize three things, that the level of suffering and the functional impairment that's associated with serious mental health concerns in older adults is profound. The suffering as well as the dysfunction lead to increased emergency room visits, increased hospitalizations, premature nursing home care, and other costs to the healthcare system. There are evidence-based practices to treat older adults with mental health concerns. This isn't a lost cause by any way, shape, or form. I'd like to share briefly a clinical vignette to give you an idea of the kinds of things that I have experienced in my own practice. There was an instance that stands out in my mind, an elderly gentleman who had a very mild dementia that came to reside in an enhanced care facility located in a nursing home where I was working in a community mental health center where my practice has been. As I explored this issue, I discovered that this man had no history of mental illness, but once he became delusional and resistive to care and combative, he was actually placed in the state mental hospital, went through the state mental hospital system, was placed into the enhanced care, and it was discovered that this had been driven by a urinary tract infection. This kind of event is not uncommon with older adults, and it has to do with the fact that there is a very complex interaction between physical health, cognitive functioning, and emotional health in older adults. We are not trained in our schools, in our medical schools, in our social work schools, within our communities to understand this. And as a result, the level of suffering and the increased costs of care are stunning. And so I want to thank you for this opportunity to just share this information. I'd like to turn this over to Dr. Jensen, who is from the Washington Institute, affiliated with the University of Washington. She's worked for over a decade in training geriatric mental health specialists in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. DeYoung. And Dr. Jensen, I want to apologize for you coming all the way down here last week, and we were not able to hear that bill. We're on such a very tight schedule, but I'm so glad that you were able to participate this morning. So I'm turning it over to you, and please introduce yourself and tell us just a little bit about your background.
Okay, thank you. And thanks for the apology. Don't worry, I took the opportunity to spend some of my hard-earned money on your economy down there.
That's great.
Anyway, I have worked in Washington State for about the last 12 years in geriatric mental health to improve services to older adults. And I've been an affiliate of the Washington Institute for Mental Illness Research and Training, which is a public academic institute through the University of Washington and the Washington State Department of Health and Human Services. And our goal has been to bridge the public academia work with the public system, so the service to sciences bridge. And I've been a longstanding member of the Washington State Mental Health Planning and Advisory Council, and we have a subcommittee on older adult treatment and services, and that is to focus on the federal block grant, which is a requirement of CMS. And more recently, I've been an expert panel with the Public Health Services SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's Older American Substance Abuse and Mental Health Technical Assistance Center. And a major focus of that center is to disseminate the knowledge base that we already have around geriatric best practices and evidence-based practices. So I've got a lot of background in training the workforce, and a lot of my work has been to really implement our geriatric mental health specialist training certificate program. And by specialized geriatric mental health certificate program, we don't just focus, what you heard from Dr. Dion, we don't just focus on the mental health aspects of aging, but it's so important to focus on the physical aspects, the normal age-related changes with older adults, substance abuse, health and disease, comorbidity is a huge issue. And I was taken back by the discussion last time about the glaucoma in your Senate bill on glaucoma, and it's a huge problem with the older adult population and highly correlated with depression in older adults, as you might suspect. So in regards to geriatric mental health specialist training, we see the whole gamut of issues facing older adults. And the demand for training is just huge. It's enormous. We have the expertise, but we don't have the workforce to serve older adults. There's so many federal papers and documents, the President's New Freedom Initiative on Mental Health, stating that we're pretty much in a crisis level with regards to working with older adults, and we need to do a lot more to train the workforce around older adult issues. We need to start we're already late in addressing these issues. And I think this has to happen at the state and federal level. If it happens at the county level and the local level, there's always competition for scarce resources. And older adults always seem to be at the back of the line, and there's so many more priorities with children, with the Children's Mental Health Initiative and older or adult populations. So older adults really don't have that voice to move this issue forward, so it's left to us to do that for them. But in the early 1980s, the Washington legislature filed an administrative code to create mental health professionals and specialists, so we've been doing it for a long time. And the Washington State Legislature and the Mental Health Division identified the need to have well-trained mental health professionals with specialized training for, we have special populations in Washington State, and we have for decades, and our special populations are children, ethnic minorities, individuals with disabilities, and older adults, and we define older adults as those 60 years of age and older. And a specific certificate training for those special populations that requires 100 hours of specialized training over the course of a year and an equivalent of 1 year of full experience working with that population, older adults specifically in this case, and supervised by a geriatric mental health specialist. And we also have a little waiver in there that if you've worked in the field with older adults for many years, you can get grandfathered in. So we have that in Washington State, and it's really been beneficial to older adults and their family members. It's not just understanding the mental health and physical aspects of aging, but understanding the systems of care, which are so fragmented, and how to get older adults the best care, the most culturally competent, age-appropriate, and coordinated care as possible. And we've done this over the years at a really cost-effective rate. Because we've been doing it for so long, we probably can do it a lot cheaper than a state that's just starting this out. But we can train 40 mental health case managers for the 100-hour training at about $15,000 to $20,000 a shot. And that includes paying honoraria to speakers, housing participants that travel from across the state at local hotels. Our state is much like Oregon in that we have very rural areas, and transportation is a real barrier for those folks. So we bring people to the training to make it as easy and accessible as possible. And all the training materials, a training coordinator, there's no tuition to the staff that are coming to the class. It's all paid through state funds, and we use federal block grant dollars oftentimes to fund those trainings. So Oregon's a bit behind, not unlike most states. A lot of states are just getting on the bandwagon to create specialized geriatric mental health training. We certainly have a lot to do. The good news is that you have to start somewhere. The pioneers in our geriatric mental health system who were trained in the early 80s have gone on to do great things in our state to develop older adult programs, including the Gatekeeper Program, which is an access program, and Oregon has a number of these as well. We have geriatric crisis teams, peer counseling, and all these programs have been recognized and disseminated nationally. Most recently, we've done a lot of partnerships with our DSHS Aging and Disability Services Administration and our Division of Alcohol and Substance Abuse, because we've recognized that the needs don't just stay within one division. They're cross-system issues, and if we can train people across systems in this work, then we're really benefiting families and older adults. We've done a lot to bring evidence-based practice models training to the state. A big thing is IMPACT, which is a primary care mental health integration model that was developed out of UCLA and University of Washington. We've brought the SAMHSA, Older American Substance Abuse Mental Health Technical Assistance Center, here to do training on co-occurring substance abuse and mental health services. And most recently, I developed a 40-hour training on co-occurring substance use and mental health disorders among older adults. So we have the knowledge base. We just are desperately in need of the recruitment and retaining of the workforce, and as you know, that costs money. We need some money to start developing the training curriculum. Actually, we have the training curriculum here. I've sent it down to Oregon, that the curriculum that we use. We need the support to provide training for actual people who can go out and do the work. You know, we're woefully underfunded in mental health, as we heard in the testimony last week, and there's going to be continued competition for the scarce resources. And like I said earlier, older adults often are at the end of the line for the support, which is why it's so important to have the state committed to supporting older adult geriatric mental health specialists. When you leave it up to the counties and the local level, again, there's other priority populations like adults with serious mental illness and children. And we don't like to compete for the few dollars, but it is important to really start developing the workforce for this population. There's so many barriers for older adults. I think you've heard this from Dr. Dion, ageism, stigma, fragmented systems of care, inadequate funding through Medicare and Medicaid, and a whole host of barriers that keep older adults out of the system. I know the state of Oregon has many experts in the field. You heard from Tim Malone last week about his program in Deschutes County, the great work of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. You already have the foundation in place to build a workforce. You just need to move forward with the funding and the support of Senate Bill 847 to move this along. Less untreated, you heard this from Dr. Dion too, older adults are more likely to experience diminished functioning, poor health, poor quality of life, and increased mortality and suicide is the highest among the older adult population, especially men. We already pay for the services, like Dr. Dion said, their emergency room services, premature nursing home placements, and other long-term care placements and suicide. So we have the tools and expertise. All we need is the support for Senate Bill 847 to build upon the foundation to create geriatric mental health specialization and services in Oregon. And I have to say, on a personal note, after being in the system for about 12 years, I get lots of phone calls from friends and colleagues and other people in the field asking me how in the heck they can get services for their older loved one, many of whom are misdiagnosed, undiagnosed, and you can't believe how many have urinary tract infections, like Dr. Dion pointed out, which really presents very differently among older adults and younger people, but are misdiagnosed and sends them down the wrong path for services. So on behalf of older adults and their families and service providers, I hope you support Senate Bill 847.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jensen. Are there any questions for her?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordley, then Senator Carter.
Thank you very much. Dr. Jensen, this is Senator Gordley from Portland. Thank you so much for your testimony and for your work over the years. And I'm wondering, I would like to see the training curriculum that you have sent to Oregon. Where did that, where was that training curriculum sent to?
Back when Sandra Moreland was at the Addictions and Mental Health Division.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be somewhere there.
Okay.
She's no longer with the division. So her colleague at the state might have it as well, but I'd be happy to send it again.
Don't send it again. We'll find it.
Okay. And if you don't find it, let me know.
And then follow up, are you familiar with Dr. Fred Miller at all at Oregon Health Sciences University?
Rings a bell.
Okay.
But no.
Has done some work, a great deal of work around mental health and the senior population, and I would just encourage you to add him to your list of resource people in our state.
Great.
Sounds like
you. I might say that whenever you can find a connection with someone at a university, you know, use that expertise. And often, unfortunately, often the information stays in the ivory tower and doesn't translate into the real world. So sounds like maybe he's been doing some work there and it'll benefit your state.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Good morning, Dr. Jensen. Margaret Carter, Northeast Portland. I'm concerned in terms of the academic preparation for this, or you take people at master's degree level and then that certification over a year would cost $20,000. Would you embellish that a little bit?
Sure. We already have a lot of identified experts in our state, but we really utilize a combination of people that are working in the field already, who've been working in the field for a long time and have the expertise, because we want to transfer just the real-life information to these clinicians. But we also utilize the expertise of individuals at the universities and colleges who've done a lot of work, especially at the UW here in Seattle, around best practices and evidence-based practices. So we utilize people who have sort of a services background with regards to the major DSHS divisions. We really want to dispel the myths around who's responsible for serving whom, under what circumstances, and with what funding. So we always have training around what DSHS Mental Health Division can do, what Aging and Disability Services can do, what Division of Alcohol and Substance Abuse can do. So we're really doing cross-systems training and pulling in a lot of experts from a lot of different areas and long-term care. And then the cost, like I said, well, since I've been involved in it, I'm kind of a cost cutter, and I find every possible way to cut costs and get a lot of freebies to do training. But in terms of really funding the housing of individuals from across the state. It's a major part of the budget, paying honorarium to people who deserve to get honorarium through a very busy lives, and the cost of materials, you know, Xeroxing these big binders of training materials. But I think that's really quite inexpensive, and the 100 hours can be implemented in many different ways in our state. We've done like Friday and a Saturday over the course of a year. Our latest model is doing a 40-hour training all in 1 week, and then two-day booster trainings over the rest of the month, the rest of the months of the year, to get the 100 hours in. So you can do it in many different ways. We haven't had people do any teleconferencing training because we believe that the face-to-face interaction amongst the trainers and the participants is very important. And we have really opened up the training. When we've done a big training with like the IMPACT program to the University of Washington, which is a major evidence-based practice model in primary care and mental health, we had a two-day training in that and opened it up to anyone else who was interested in that. So that was a little added cost to get a bigger venue. And we invited folks actually from Oregon to come up and hear the training as well. So you really, it's sort of thinking out of the box and really sort of advocating for whatever you can get to do the training. It's better when you have, of course, the targeted training dollars to do it, and then you just keep building upon that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, there's no further discussion. I want to thank you again, Dr. Jensen, and we may call on you again in the future if we need resources.
Okay. Well,
all
right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. With that, I'd like to close the public. Yeah, I'm closing the public hearing right now since we're running over time, and I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 847.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 847 to the Full Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 847 to Ways and Means with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Any opposition?
Do we have any idea of the fiscal on this?
No, we don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want to give us a little bit, Bob Nickel?
Madam Chair, for the record, Bob Nickel, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services and Addictions and Mental Health Division. Our fiscal impact statement says $339,000 per biennium. I think that's a fairly minimal number. I'm not sure that the costs, if we were to do this, of paying stipends to bring people in or even paying mileage and hotel rooms and those kind of things is included in that. So I'll go back and get a little bit more detail on it, but I think $339,000 is mostly the cost of one FTE and some services and supplies, but I would want to go back and take a second look at that. It's considerably less money than we heard from the state of Washington, depending on how many people were trained. I'm not sure if I had a chance to put our testimony on the record the other day because I found about 20 copies of my testimony.
We didn't hear the bill, so you
did. You did hear the bill, but I'm not sure if I turned in this, so I'm going to turn it in.
That's fine.
And make sure because it'll be on the record then.
Great.
For sure.
Excellent. Thank you. Is there any other discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And so that will be going on down to Ways and Means. I'd like to open a public hearing on SCR 13. And Senator Schrader is the chief sponsor. He's not here, but I would like to move this bill. The Oregon Health Care Association gave testimony, and they highly would like us to support recognizing the legacy of State Senator George Ivers through this resolution. He was really an active member of the lawn care industry who brought gumption and tenacity to the profession, and he was a member of the Oregon Health Care Association for many years through his development and operation of Milwaukee Convalescent Center. And I think that we'll just allow Senator Schrader to espouse the wonderful works of former Senator Ivers. So with that, I would like to close the public hearing on SCR 13 and open a work session on SCR 13.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 13 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves SCR 13 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. With that, now I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill. Senator Schrader is the carrier. And I would now like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 751. And Tom Barrows and Dr. Lyden Johansson.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I'm Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. With me is Dr. Lyden Johansson, president of that association. We're here to urge your support for Senate Bill 751, which would grant full voting rights to the podiatrist on the Board of Medical Examiners. Last session, the legislature passed a bill to put a podiatrist on the board. And at the end, it was amended to restrict the voting rights of that person to only issues dealing with podiatry. We think that that should be corrected. Both the Oregon Medical Association and the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon have indicated to me that they're neutral on this bill. The membership of the board set in statute presently 7 MDs, 2 osteopaths, 2 public members with no medical background, and 1 doctor of podiatric medicine. The DPM member is the only one with restriction on voting rights. The public members vote on all issues. The MDs and the DOs are not restricted to only their profession. Last year, Dr. Lisa Cornelius was appointed to the board by the governor. She's a podiatrist. She gets all the materials, participates in all the discussions, but when it comes time to vote, she's only allowed to vote on podiatry issues. And with that, I'd like to ask Dr. Johansson to give a brief background on the education and training of DPMs.
Thank you. We go to 4 years.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Lyden Johansson. I'm the current president of the Oregon Podiatry Medical Association. And with regards to our training, we go to 4 years of doctoral training. It's 2 years are very synonymous with current medical schools. We take pharmacology, general anatomy, neuroanatomy, all the basic sciences that either a DO or MD would take. We do specialize to the foot and ankle more sooner in the last 2 years of training. During that training, though, we have studies and workshops and classes in history and physical. Once again, these are taught by MDs or DOs at our schools. After that, we have anywhere from 1, 2 to 3 years of residency training. Most of these are hospital-based. All podiatrists are surgically trained. We have full prescription coverage writing specific to our scope of practice. And we admit patients to hospitals for surgery. We work both in hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. And most of our referrals come from MDs and DOs.
Madam Chair, I'd like to add one other thing. I have seen the testimony that the Board of Medical Examiners has submitted, and I'd like to point out that a DPM is a separate degree, different from MD-DO. So prior to the addition of the DPM member on the board, they were actually prohibited by statute from being on the board. It's not a subspecialty of one of the others. It is a separate degree. So the bill last session put them on the board. This just allows them to vote along with everyone else. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any discussion from the committee?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Gordley.
Now, I'd like to better understand the history surrounding the exclusion, the ability to vote on all matters.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I the history of the position on the board itself from last session or the history of the boards being merged? I'm sorry.
Not the merger of the boards, but the exclusion from voting.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, my understanding is that there was opposition last session from the Oregon Medical Association and the Board of Medical Examiners to House Bill 2490. I believe this was a compromise that the chair of the Senate Rules Committee made to give the other side something, I think. I don't know why that exclusion was made. It didn't make sense to us at the time, but we weren't given a choice.
Thank you, yes. Madam Chair. I would just, with the folks who are following, who will be testifying on the matter, whatever they can do to flesh out the history behind this for this record would be very helpful.
No one else, Senator Gordley, has signed up, just the letter that from the Board of Medical Examiners, but we certainly can call them up if you so desire.
Yes, I would. I think it's really important that we have a record that establishes why this exclusion exists, that we have the record in this committee. Mm-hmm. I understand this comes out of a previous session and previous
and
thinking.
Thank you. And if Senate Bill 717 has any legs in this, it may, and that is the scope of practice bill, colleagues. It may behoove us to have a variety on the Board of Medical Examiners other than just MDs. So with that statement, Kathleen Healy, do you want to come up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathleen Healy, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Examiners. I'm not sure that I can add a lot more to what Mr. Barrows has said about what happened last session. My understanding is that it was a compromise that was reached, that the podiatric member would vote only on disciplinary cases that were involving their scope of practice.
And with that said, but the public members can vote on everything.
Chair, Senator Gordley, that's true. Their role is as they can't have any health care background as part of their experience coming into the position to serve on the board. They're there to represent consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, committee, I would like to know what the wishes of the committee are, whether we go forward with this or whether... Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 751. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 751.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 751 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves that Senate Bill 757 be...
751.
Pardon?
751.
What did I say? 751 be moved to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And Senator Morissette is the chief sponsor of this bill, and he will carry it. With that, I will close the public work session on Senate Bill 751. And I would like to open a public hearing. We are not hearing Senate Bill 153, if there's anyone here for, because we have no amendment. And so we need the amendment. So is that all right, Cindy? Okay. Is Dr. Bates in yet? If not, we're going to have to recess until 9:15, or we could start. He would like to start this off. And I know that he was flying in, and he said he could not be here before 7:15. So would you give a call to his office to see how that is? And with that, we're in recess until we get a call back. And get into public hearing because it's now 9:15. And I would like to open a work session, public hearing, on Senate Bill 924. And that would be Betsy Earls and Dave Fiscom. Betsy Earls and Dave Fiscom.
There's the second page.
All right, how about Mike Crew or Joe Henry? Bill Dunlap, would you rather have John Powell?
Where's John? John was here. Dave Fiskum has entered the room.
Madam Chair, our preference was to have Mr. Becker go first for Regents. We were all kind of outside waiting for the recess to be over.
Okay, it's over, and we're starting with Senate Bill 924, and we will have... who do you want first? Doesn't matter to me. Who was? OMA was?
We also thought that for Blitzer go first. We're all just out in the audience. Yes.
Okay.
At your discretion.
Yeah. Well, that's why I wanted Bates, Crew, Henry, and Dunlap, because they are proponents.
Madam Chair, I'm Mike Crew, but Mr. Dunlap went downstairs to get something to drink. I hope you'll be back in just a moment.
Okay. Well, I should have said that we were going to start at 9:15 because that. Oh, I did say that. Okay. All right. Would you like to start? Maybe describe the bill a little bit.
Madam Chair, Senator, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney in Portland. Our law firm, Cooney & Crew, is general counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. And I have the privilege of representing physicians throughout the state, as well as physician organizations. Mr. Henry is here. He also is his company, Henry & Associates, contracts for and on behalf of doctors with insurance plans, and I'm sure he'll explain to you what he does. Mr. Dunlap, who's not here, who hopefully will show up in a minute, is an employee of Epic Imaging, Eastside Portland Imaging Center. They are a large radiology practice who was cut out of a plan, and he would like to explain what happened to them when that happened. A little bit of background on the bill. Senate Bill 924 was proposed by the OMA and introduced, I believe, by Senator Bates. And the bill, unfortunately, the OMA has proposed some amendments. I think Senator Bates has given those to legislative council, and those amendments are not before the committee this morning. It substantially reduces the scope of the bill. But for the record, when those amendments come out, I think there will be further amendments to be made. One of them will be that we will be asking that the impact of this bill be limited to just physicians and nurse practitioners. I know that there is a company up in Portland, Willamette Dental, does not want dentists involved, and we have no issue with that. We represent physicians, and that's where we'll leave it. Senate Bill 924, as amended, will effectively, it's directed at insurance companies, and it's directed essentially at three practices. The first practice is the practice of insurance companies that own, operate, or control an outpatient facility, steering patients to those facilities when the patient should have a choice as to where they wish to receive their services. And this bill basically says insurance companies cannot do that. The second thing this bill does is that it stops insurance companies from subletting their panel of providers. Now, let me explain. And I might add, it stops insurance companies and any company affiliated with an insurance company from doing this. What's happening in the market currently is that insurance companies will enter into contracts with doctors to provide services for their plan. And then they will sublet those doctors to another insurance company. If it stopped at one or two insurance companies, we in fact wouldn't be here today. But in fact, this is happening dozens and dozens of times by the same insurance companies. And doctors, the first thing this does is it diverts money out of the healthcare system because these other insurance companies are paying for access to these physician panels. And presumably those same dollars could be used to provide healthcare. And in at least one case, we're talking millions of dollars. Secondly, it aggregates market power. One insurance company can, in fact, represent hundreds of other insurance companies. Doctors cannot afford to negotiate with or have any say in the compensation that they're to be paid. Basically, they have no choice. They have to take that contract. And that, in fact, is happening currently in this state with at least one insurance company. And it really... it takes away from physicians the ability to bargain, if you will, as to who they will contract with. The other thing that it does conceptually is, and this is happening. I had this case walk into my office about 3 weeks ago. A doctor calls and says, I have no contract with this insurance company. The OMA called me and said, where did this company come from? It's off the East Coast. What provider contract do they have? And we tried to track it down, and we couldn't track it down. But what happens is insurance co contracts with company B or company A. Company A turns around and subcontracts to company B to company C, and so forth. And we're seeing this, and this is what we call silent PPOs, a silent PPO network. This causes confusion in the minds of the doctors. It certainly causes contract disputes between doctors and the payor. In some cases, the payor changes the amount of compensation to be paid and or the rules of participation. And it's creating great difficulties in medical practices. The other thing this bill does is it addresses a rather pernicious activity that's going on every day with insurance companies. That is simply this. Assume that I'm a doctor. A patient walks in, hands me their insurance card, and says, I am eligible for benefits with this insurance plan. By the doctor, call that plan, or I get on the internet. I check eligibility. I provide the service in good faith. I then find out 2, 3, 4 weeks, 6 weeks later, no, that patient wasn't eligible. Well, technically, the patient may have had the card. We may listed them as an eligible on our insurance plan, but unfortunately, the employer didn't pay the premium, and therefore, this patient wasn't eligible, and we're not going to pay the bill. The bill, as amended, would say simply this, that if a patient comes into a doctor's office with an insurance card and the doctor confirms eligibility with the plan within 72 hours or on the day of service, the plan cannot thereafter deny coverage to the doctor. If there's a dispute as between the plan and the employer or the plan and the patient, let the plan suffer the loss, not the doctor. And then finally, the bill creates a private right of action for violation of these provisions so that if an insurance company should refuse to pay or attempts to contract downstream, and if a doctor is injured by that, they would have a right to bring an action in court to recover their actual damages, plus attorney's fees or $500, whichever is more.
Thank you for the very good explanation of the bill, because I was trying to read it, and I said, I hope the testimony is good. And it was. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Joseph Henry. I am president of Henry & Associates. Our address is 10700 Southwest Beaverton Hillsdale Highway, Suite 585, Beaverton, Oregon. Henry & Associates is a 20-year-old consulting company. Our primary business is negotiating insurance company contracts on behalf of physicians and physician groups. We provide services throughout the state of Oregon. I'm here this morning to discuss the specific part of the bill that Mike gave you an overview on, addressing what we call panel renting. That's where the primary insurance company rents the panel to other payors and insurance companies. It's my strongly held opinion that the practice of panel renting is very detrimental to physicians, consumers, physician office staffs, and even some smaller insurance companies. The way the system currently functions is that the physicians are presented a contract from a major insurer to sign each year, which contains, among many other components, a specific conversion factor or payment rate. A clause in the contract, which is non-negotiable, gives the insurance company the right to rent or broker the physician services to other insurance companies and direct payors. While the payment rate must be contractually the same, the terms, conditions, and administrative rules can and do vary significantly among the various other insurance companies. This presents very real problems when, as in the case of one major insurer in the state, about 150 companies rent this panel. This results in much confusion and significantly greater administrative problems for the office staffs. Each of the 150 companies have their own payment rules. When administrative issues arise, the physician office staff must deal with personnel with whom they have never worked. They sometimes have difficulty even finding out how to contact the company representatives. Also, payment rules may vary, which does in fact impact the payment rates ultimately received by the physicians. But a much more serious problem occurs when the insurance broker decides not to renew the contract with the physician. Not only does the physician lose the patients from the primary insurer, but all the patients from the other companies are also lost to the physician. This very thing happened recently to a client of mine with whom I've worked for the past several years. This client is a four-physician practice which has been providing services to the main or primary insurer and all the 150 brokered insurers for over 15 years. These are highly qualified physicians who are willing to provide services even at a lower cost to the patients, yet they were unable to do so. This was not due to the wants and demands of the patients, but was due to a unilateral decision on the part of the primary insurer. I would like to reemphasize that the physicians could no longer see any of the patients from the approximately 150 insurer payers represented in the contract. It should also be noted that the insurer acknowledged that there were absolutely no concerns with the quality of care that the physicians had provided over the past 15 years, nor were there any patient complaints about the care being provided. This type of unilateral decision harms a number of groups. Patients that had been seeing these physicians for the past 15 years no longer had access to the physicians. This particular practice was a specialty practice, and other physicians who had been referring their patients from those 150 companies could no longer do so and had to inform their patients that they could no longer see my clients. This decision was devastating to the physician group in that a significant percentage of their practice was taken away without warning and with no opportunity to negotiate. The key issue here, and the issue addressed in the bill, is not that the insurance company should not be allowed to contract with whomever they want and negotiate the terms they want. The issue is that they should not have the power to make decisions on behalf of other insurers to whom they rent their physician panels. This panel renting practice is detrimental to physicians and patients and gives too much control and power to a small number of insurers. The physicians are completely cut out of the contracting process, yet are required to follow rules and regulations, which they often never see. The only beneficiary of this panel renting practice is the primary insurance company that rents the panel for a healthy profit. Panel renting results in higher costs and less access to the consumer and should not be allowed. It is my opinion this bill will eliminate this practice that is unfair to private practicing physicians and healthcare consumers throughout the state. Thank you.
Questions? Okay.
Good morning. My name is William Dunlap. I'm the administrative director of Epic Imaging. We provide outpatient radiology services here in the state of Oregon. The business began in 1959 with Dr. Fersch. It was purchased in 1964 by Dr. Gerald Warnock, who's the current owner. Dr. Warnock, through Epic Imaging, was the first in the state of Oregon to provide patients with digital mammography. We're also the first in the state to have PET scanners. In September, we'll be the first in the state to have an upright MRI machine so patients can have exams weight-bearing, which is beneficial sometimes medically. We also, just this year, obtained a new technology called PEM, positron emission mammography. We're the first in the state to have that technology, and it helps identify breast cancer in women. Last July, without warning, Providence Healthcare Systems, who's in charge of a large IPA panel here in the state of Oregon, removed us without cause. We'd been referred to them as the gold standard in radiology. We believe we provide the highest quality, the best services at the lowest price, yet they removed us from their panel simply so they could have all the examinations performed at facilities that they own. When they did that, it immediately took 20% of our business away because they represent over 100 insurance companies. In addition to that, they threatened referring physicians that could send us patients that for which they don't have control over the insurance plans to remove them from their panels if they continue to send patients to our facility. So I would appreciate you giving this bill serious consideration. I think it would level the playing field. There's a lot of misaligned incentives right now in the marketplace in healthcare. I think this would help resolve that issue.
Question. So if someone is removed from the panel and they said, no, I want to go there, could you still get reimbursed but at a lower rate? Is that, I mean, they out of, what is it called, out of service?
It depends on a patient's insurance. Some insurance plans allow patients to go out of network.
Out of network is the word, yeah.
Some don't. It has caused great confusion in the marketplace. And it had actually hurt our business more than 20% because some doctors quit sending us patients because it was just so confusing. So we made the decision last December to open it back up and accept all insurance plans, even though for many of them we're going to get paid nothing, just to eliminate the confusion in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. That hurts us as a business because it doesn't allow us to have the capital then to invest in new equipment in the future, which is going to benefit the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Amazing. Yes, Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, and good morning.
Good morning.
You have testified that your company was removed from the panel without cause. Can you say more about that? How were you notified, and what was the content of the information that you received about the removal?
It said that as of July 1st, 2005, that they were no longer going to allow us to be part of the panel and that we could no longer see physicians or patients at our facilities. And I believe it was about a 90-day notice that they gave us. So we knew 90 days in advance that it was going to happen, but there wasn't anything we could do to stop it.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, now let's call the thank you very much, gentlemen, for being here. Appreciate your testimony. It was very clear and valuable. John Powell, Mike Becker, Steve Petruzzilli, and Mike Dewey. Maybe Steve and Mike can come together, John and Mike Becker together. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. I'm representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. With me is Mike Becker, an attorney with Regents, who he's not an attorney practicing in Oregon. He is a trained attorney. And to answer questions that you might have. Madam Chair and members, it's difficult for us to testify today because there are amendments pending. And however, we were given a copy of the instructions to Legislative Council. So if the amendments come out as the instructions given, we can kind of give you a flavor for actually what the bill would do in that amended form.
Well, don't feel like you have to testify just to testify, because if truly you're waiting for the amendments, and I'm we're going to have a public hearing again once the amendments are done. So keep it short and okay. Quick.
Madam Chair, perhaps given that, I would simply refer you to page 2 of the printed bill, line 31. That is the heart of this bill. And notwithstanding any particular providers' issues that have been presented, this section is not only very destructive of the PPO model. It basically eliminates it. If you look at line 31, it would say that no insurer may restrict or in any way limit an enrollee's access to or choice of any willing provider of a specified health care service that is performed on an outpatient basis. That, in and of itself, destroys contracting. Why would somebody contract with you when there's really no advantage? The next section, beginning on line 33, says an insurance company may not create incentives, including but not limited to financial incentives or expanded coverage, to induce an enrollee to obtain specific health care services that are performed on an outpatient basis from a preferred provider or at a health care facility or other entity owned or operated by or affiliated associated with the health insurer. that prohibition is what a preferred provider is. If you look over on page 3 at line 43, the current law defines what a preferred provider organization insurance is. And just at the top of page 4, line 3 and 4, it says it is an insurance system that creates financial incentives for an enrollee to use the preferred provider network of providers by providing an increased level of benefits. That's existing law and not amended by this bill. And those sections are just totally contradictory.
Okay, question then. Insurance companies are wanting to make money, so they want to get a facility, an imaging facility, and therefore, when they set up contracts with various entities, they decide, well, we're not going to set up a contract so that people can go to, forget what it is, Epic Imaging. I mean, to me, that's sort of foul play.
Madam Chair, that specific issue does not involve our company. But I have to say, you're looking at several different models of insurance. Some are exempted by the bill. An HMO, for example. If you're operating under an HMO license, you're exempted from the provision of this bill, even though there are HMO models that are starting to offer preferred provider networks. So they could continue to do that, I assume, under that license. What you're dealing with in the case, I think, that was presented is an insurer that's affiliated with a provider. They already provide medical services through hospitals and the like.
Like Providence.
Yes. And their system.
But not Blue Cross.
Madam Chair, this would not affect. Blue Cross doesn't have a own facility.
That's right. I just need to get it clear.
But the effects of this bill would have, if that was the intended consequence to deal with imaging, many, many unintended consequences of basically destroying a preferred provider network, which is defined in the law and specifically created to allow contracting for the benefit of controlling health care costs.
But it just makes sense to me, though, when these contracts are set up, if the insurance companies have a vested interest in a facility that provides services, that they would then take the market share. I mean, they would want those contracts set up so that they would get the market share and not have it go out, correct? I'm reading this right, correct?
Madam Chair, that's a practice that would be prohibited under this bill. But again, the consequences of this language, while hitting that target, also hits the practices of us dealing with physicians and other healthcare issues.
Okay.
So instead of a rifle, it's a shotgun and destroys the very basis of our system at Regents.
I understand. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
What we ultimately are trying to get at through this measure is good public policy. And so if you could help us address that and answer this question, how is it good public policy that an insurer would operate in a manner that has the effect of denying enrollee access and choice?
Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, that's a very good question. In exchange for a contracted price, provider gets volume. And in in exchange for that, they lower their price. Consumers then can afford to buy the health insurance that pays for that bill. And I think that's the policy issue at hand. In all of the reform hearings that are underway, it seems like the underlying principle in all of that is getting to some form of managed or contracted health care, if not even on a capitated basis. So I think anybody that looks at health care in terms of the rising cost of health care knows that somebody has to negotiate for the individuals who are seeking health care. And the only negotiation that's going on in that regard now is health plans, as opposed to individuals going in and negotiating their own fee with a doctor or a hospital or an imaging center. So I think the public policy issue is, if you do away with that, then there will be an escalation of health care costs.
Great. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, there are several other issues, and we'll just hold those until we see the final amendments and testify.
That sounds great.
And I have a question about the amendments, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just so that I understand, there are two sets of amendments, those offered by the Oregon Medical Association, and then amendments that we're expecting from Dr. Bates. Is that?
No.
Okay.
Clarify. Madam Chair, that reference may have been to the bill that you were going to hear before this one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. We will. When do you? Does anyone have a sense? Probably Dr. Bates's office does. When the amendments? Has anyone been told when those amendments will be done? Oh, Dr. Bates, do you know when the amendments are going to be done? Okay. I was wondering, I think what we'll do is we will carry this bill over for tomorrow night's meeting in case the amendments are done by then. And we will then hear it tomorrow night. But we'll put it on the schedule for tomorrow night. 5:15, I think, is when we start. I mean, we have a huge number of bills that we're going to get through. So, all right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, you may want me to defer some of my comments. I'm Steve Petrozelli. I'm the president and CEO of Willamette Dental Management. You'll know us as Willamette Dental Group. And again, I want to thank the sponsors for removing dentistry from this. It's a little more complicated than that, however, from the standpoint that our particular model, we're an insurance company. We're a group of dental providers. All of our providers are associated dentist employees. Some in specialists in the past and maybe in the future not only will be DMD but MDs, in, as an example, oral surgery. So whatever amendments we're talking about, I want to make sure we take all of that into consideration. We not only, our provider panel, not only provides for our own insurance entities, but as it's called in here, rents out to organizations such as Regents. We provide for their DentaCare program, as an example, and at least one national carrier I'll mention is Aetna, for employers that seek a capitated model that we provide for, who maybe the employers outside the area but have employees within the area, etc. I just want to be careful that whatever legislation is drafted takes all of that into consideration, because there are several small closed panel models, such as Kaiser and ourselves, that have been operating in this jurisdiction in Oregon for probably 35 years or longer. My last two comments are kind of to address some of the comments here. From time to time, as we've grown as an organization, we have brought certain services into our organization that were done on the outside, and we've taken certain services in the past that we've done on the inside and outsourced them based on cost and based on whether we felt we could get the best quality. And those change from time to time. We all know the drastic evolution that healthcare is going through as a aspect of the costs that are driving a lot of these issues and everything. And my only concern is that we do not set up a model or prohibit models from making decisions that ultimately deliver quality care at the best price to the patient, to the payer, or maybe even the taxpayer, depending on the plan. And that is my other concern as we look at amending this and working with it. As an employer, we have about 1,200 employees, of which about 700 reside within this state. And believe me, as an employer, I'm in the same position as every other employer. Every year, we're looking at our health care delivery and benefit package, how we can deliver a quality product that's fair to our employees at the same time that stays within a budget that we can afford, because ultimately we have to go out and sell our plans to employers in the marketplace at a cost they can afford. And so, again, I hope that whatever is drafted here and we take a look at is not of a nature that it will prohibit other new and different types of alternative models of coming to the marketplace that would enable employers to continue to offer as quality and as cost-effective a benefit plan to their employees as necessary. With that, I will table the rest of my comments until the amendments come forward.
Thank you very much. Mr. Becker, do you wish to testify?
Madam Chair, I will save my comments for tomorrow night when
Excellent.
I see the amendments.
Thank All you. Right. With that, the only other two that we have, unless they want to defer for tomorrow night, is Mike Dooley and Dave Fiscom.
Madam Chair, I'll defer.
Okay.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Fiscom here representing Providence Health Plans. I mostly will defer in light of your comments about amendments. We were prepared on one hand to testify on the printed bill, but that appears to be not the best approach. This also was a little awkward for me because I did not know on behalf of Providence Health System that this would turn into what it's turned into by previous witnesses, which is a legal briefing on a contested case procedure or whatever it was. That has now been settled. In light of the comments made earlier to you, I will have the right people in the room tomorrow night, our legal counsel, our regulatory affairs manager, and they can, from our standpoint, set the record straight relative to the Epic Imaging situation, as well as other aspects of the comments made by the OMA testifiers earlier. I'm not prepared to do that today, and in fact, it would be, on my part, entirely inappropriate for me to make comments on such a legal proceeding as existed. My understanding via BlackBerry communication 15 minutes ago, I tried to confirm that that case actually has been settled. A comment not made to you earlier, if that's the case, and if our legal counsel suggests that in testimony tomorrow night, that's a comment you need to hear about. So I felt it was important to say that for the record to indicate we will be prepared tomorrow night, Madam Chair, in light of the testimony given to you earlier this morning.
And I really do not want to, we are going to put it on the schedule for tomorrow night, but it'll be up to you to know, to find out through our administrator whether the amendments are done or not. Because if the amendments are not done, I certainly want to then carry it over until we have those amendments. But since we're at a deadline, I'm going to just keep carrying these over each time until we get those amendments.
And Madam Chair, advice taken. I will tell you that I have read just before the hearing today a copy of conceptual amendments, which I have not yet faxed anywhere for their review. So well, I appreciate your indulgence in giving us time to review that. And it would be better for us to review legislative council amendments when done. We'll watch for those with the help of your administrator.
Yes, and legislative council has been spending extreme amount of time on certain pieces of legislation, and I'm looking at Dr. Bates right now. So hopefully he will stop that, and and we can get some of our bills done. Thank you very much.
My understanding is Senate Bill 329 is still up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So then, Madam Chair,
yes.
Does that mean that we're going to have three sets of amendments, the OMA, the ones that are currently in Legislative Council, and then the ones that Mr. Fiscom just referred to that are
Mr. Fiscom, Dave Fiscom, do you have amendments in? You do not, correct?
And I've only reviewed amendments.
So the only ones are OMA amendments. That's the only one.
Madam Chair, what yes. Dave was referring to the sheet of conceptual amendments that are going to become the amendments.
Excellent.
From OMA.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 924. and that will be carried over tomorrow, if, and we will hear it only if the amendments are done. With that, I'd like to open public hearing on Senate Bill 337. Dr. Bates, Kathleen Haley, Gwen Dayton, and Claudia Black. Because I think there's no opposition to this one, committee. We'd like to move it on. Go ahead, Dr. Bates. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from District 3. I'm also a physician in Southern Oregon. We're going to bring you two bills today. First, I'm going to apologize, Madam Chair, for 924 and me being a little late getting here and driving madly up the freeway this morning. We'll be working 924 before you see it again. And hopefully it'll be something that's a little more understandable for everybody.
Excellent.
And I also apologize for monopolizing certain people's time in LC.
I'll be getting...
guilty as accused, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and committee members, we bring you Senate Bill 337 this morning. This is a bill which I think represents the way the legislature is supposed to work. We started having work groups on this early in the session. We met in Portland three times. We had representatives from the Board of Medical Examiners, the hospital.
We haven't had an explanation of the bill.
Oops,
and so just for the record, Shannon can do that. And
Senate Bill 337 defines insurer relating to persons making payments in response to claims for professional negligence, defines certain persons within the meaning of insured for purposes of claim reporting requirement, specifies that reporting requirement continues to apply to public body if public body is substituted in place of insured as defendant in claim of alleged professional negligence. And it's my understanding that you guys have done a lot of work and that might not be what it does anymore.
I think it still basically does that. We did do a lot of work on this, and then the two ladies to my right, who I considered certified smart, and the lady sitting behind me, who's also certified smart, who will join you in a few minutes when I give her the seat, have done a great job on this. They and their legal staff have put this bill together in a very careful fashion. The bill answers, from my point of view, a couple of basic problems that we've had in the state between the physicians affected and the Board of Medical Examiners. The board needs to get information in a timely, accurate fashion in order to do its job. There have been times that didn't occur. At the same time, physicians and practitioners need to have some protection for their privacy, and most importantly, from my point of view, from the peer review process. Peer review is the way that we sit down as physicians and can have very open discussions about how we treat patients and come up with best practices. If that's opened up to the public, it will close the process down because nobody will admit any deviation from any type of protocol or treatment that in any way might have been conceived to have been negative for a patient. We look for best practices this way. As an example, in my hospital when I was chief of medicine, we went through protocols for insulin, IV drips. We went through protocols for how we treat pneumonia and how we treat congestive heart failure. There were variations in practice across the board. We were able to have very open discussions about how Dr. A did something, how Dr. B did something, how Dr. C did something, and came up with what we thought were the best protocols, which are now followed in our hospitals. That conversation can't occur if you touch peer review. People will not come to a committee and discuss failures or successes in their cases. It just won't happen. So this, I believe, does a great job of doing that. We also had a strange situation, which was unknown to me, that if a physician had his or her practice rights restricted at certain facilities in the state, if those facilities were self-insured, that commonly they would not report that to the Board of Medical Examiners. The individual physician was supposed to, but there was no way of cross-checking that. This bill corrects that problem. I think it's a good bill. It protects peer review, but at the same time gives the Board of Medical Examiners the information they need to do the job we want them to do. And people here with you today will go through the bill more specifically with you. I think it's a good bill. I think it's complete. I think it needs to move out of committee and onto the floor, and hope you'll support it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask Claudia Black to come up now, Madam Chair?
She's here. She's here.
No. Okay.
Thank you.
Before we Dr. Bates, Senator Bates, is there anything in this bill that has a relationship to the work of the Patient Safety Commission that we should be aware of? Is there any intersection there?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, there's no direct connection there. Here's the same situation I talked about, peer review. The Patient Safety Commission has to work a little bit separately. We don't want the board necessarily getting involved in what they're doing there. We want a pretty bright line drawn between those two. We want an open conversation to continue to occur, both in peer review and with the Patient Safety Committee. We want information going to Patient Safety Committee about negative outcomes, frankly, and sharing that information back. I helped sponsor that initially. We would have what we call sentinel events at our hospital about once or twice a year when something really didn't go right. Usually it was a system failure, but something didn't go right, a patient was hurt or even died sometimes. And we were not allowed to share that amongst our hospital staff or across the state before. Now we can share those things. And usually it was something that was actually no fault involved, but there was a bad outcome and a patient was injured. And everyone was fearful because of medical malpractice to say a word. It was just sort of a cone of silence down around this thing. Now, through the Patient Safety Committee, we can report those events, and we can get the information back to us as individual practitioners and as hospitals and share the information and improve what we're doing for patients. As we all are very aware, the special hospital setting where things have become so complex now in the treatment of patients and so high-tech, mistakes can be made and are being made, and we're trying to correct that. We're desperately trying to make hospitals as safe as possible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bates. For the record, my name is Gwen Dayton. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And my role up here today is to go through the amendments with you and explain the changes to the existing bill and why they were made. But before I do that, I want to thank Senator Bates for his leadership on this. This bill truly deals with hard issues. And the fact that our organizations have come together to support the amendments to the bill is really a testament to Senator Bates' leadership, and we very much appreciate it, because I think we've done some good work, and that's I don't think that would have happened had he not involved himself in the process. So let me tell you what the bill as amended is. Senate Bill 337 really combines two different bills, the existing Senate Bill 337 and Senate Bill 146. Senate Bill 337 deals with reports of malpractice claims, pardon my voice today, to the appropriate licensing board. And there were some gaps in the way that the original law in that area was written, and I think we've filled those gaps, and we'll talk about that. The second part of the bill deals with reporting by hospitals and physicians of particular physicians in particular circumstances to the Board of Medical Examiners. There are completely separate sets of reports, and there were issues with that as well in terms of reporting and accountability for reporting. Senate Bill 337 is in large part rewritten, which makes it a little bit easier to explain. We, starting with the definitions, we clarified the definition of what a claim is. A claim is what we need to report under this section. And the original language was much more broad about what a claim is, and hospitals had some concerns that a lot of what we receive might qualify as a claim, and we want to make sure that we're reporting the right thing. So that term is narrowed to an official demand, or sort of written demand for payment for an injury alleged to have been caused by negligence, made in a complaint filed with the court of appropriate jurisdiction. So everybody knows what it is now, and that's a good thing. Covered practitioners, who we need to report on, was expanded just slightly to include nurse practitioners. Otherwise, it's the same as the original language. Reporters, and this is really the guts of what the changes that we made in this bill. The reason this is even really before you is because there was concern that insurers, which are the people who are supposed to report claims, really didn't necessarily include self-insurers. And speaking from the hospital perspective, some hospitals self-insure, and it was ambiguous in the statute whether they were included. We worked very hard to make sure that there are no more gaps, that a claim that is made, that is received by somebody, a malpractice claim, payment will be reported. So the reporters now are primary insurers. The term primary was added to make sure we're not including excess insurers and some of these other folks. If there's already been a report by the primary insurer, we don't need a secondary report by others. A public body required to defend, safe, harmless, etc. under ORS Chapter 30, that's essentially picking up OHSU in the bill. There's absolutely no debate about whether they should or should not be included. C is where we did a lot of work. An entity that self-insures or indemnifies for claims alleging professional negligence.
You're working on the dash
three amendments.
Three.
I am sorry.
Yeah.
That's now,
where
I'm,
we're going.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I went straight to the ones I care about, not telling you where I was. That language was really finely crafted to make sure we don't leave anybody out. And we think this does pick up those entities that self-insure or indemnify their covered practitioners. And then HMOs. Those are the reporters, and we think we fill the gap. What is reported is the claim and essentially the same information that had been reported. There's also some clarification in the bill, and now I'm on page, the bottom of page 3 and going on to page 4 about what the board that receives the report does with the report and what information they can publicly disclose. That was it's a finely honed compromise between the needs of consumers to know and the needs of practitioners or fairness to practitioners, that we're not necessarily going to disclose information about a claim that wasn't found to have merit, for example. That is the guts of the changes we made to the reporting of a malpractice claim to the appropriate licensing board. The second part of this bill amends the Medical Practice Act reporting section. Essentially, there are two avenues for reporting under this section. The hospitals report official action that's taken against a physician. That means an actual restriction or limitation on privileges, denial of privileges or license to practice medicine, or any formal action taken. We have been required to report that for some time. Physicians are also required to report under the statute on professional conduct, essentially. The reason this came up for amendment is I think there was, not wanting to speak for Kathleen, but there was a concern on the part of the Board of Medical Examiners that there really wasn't accountability for reporting or failure to report. So what is in here is a penalty that can be assessed against hospitals and can be assessed against physicians that do not report. And I think that goes a long ways towards meeting the Board of Medical Examiners' concerns. The concerns that hospitals and physicians have had with this statute is what we report. Senator Bates talked about the peer review issue, and that's a very real one with this reporting. We, as hospitals and physicians, certainly don't want to be in the position of reporting peer review data to the board because it implicates the confidentiality of that information and all the quality concerns we would have with that. So we spent a lot of time crafting language that details what physicians and hospitals should report when they report a physician, and those are contained on page 6 and to the end of the bill, essentially. And we think that they clarify it. We don't have to have our arguments anymore with the Board of Medical Examiners, and we're glad for that. And we can report with what's in the bill, and we think that meets their needs as well. Again, the section is amended to provide for a penalty of $10,000 for each violation, for each failure to report an official action by a hospital. And then the Physician Practice Act is also amended on page 8 to impose that same penalty on physicians. So there now is increased accountability for reporting. And that's the guts of it. The rest of it is largely housekeeping. I'm glad to go over it if you'd like, but understanding that you've got a lot on your plate today, I will defer that for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, who's next? Does anyone want to testify? Because we do need to leave for the floor.
Chairman Sanderson, I just want to thank Senator Bates again and everyone else who participated to make this come together.
Okay. And Claudia Black with Oregon Medical Association. I'd just like to echo those comments. We appreciate Senator Bates' leadership and the work of our colleagues in putting this bill together.
Excellent.
Thank you.
With that, I am... Are there anyone else? Okay. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 337 and open a work session on Senate Bill 337.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 337 to the Senate floor with
Dash
the...
Three.
Oh, thank you. Madam Chair. I move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 337.
Senator Gordley moves the dash threes to Senate Bill 337. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, Mark Courtney and Carter as excused.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 337 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 337 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Senator Bates, will you carry that and say Courtney and Carter are excused? And with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 337. And I'm sorry we did not get to Senate Bill 924 and 925. We are carrying them over to tomorrow night because we have to leave. What do you need?
I'm sorry. We have a witness that came from Southern Oregon.
Sure. Yes, we have to leave here by be on the floor at 10:15. So which bill is this?
925.
So let me open a brief, where we'll continue tomorrow, on Senate Bill 925. And that is, is it Helsinger? Dr. Helsinger. And so 925, just briefly describe the bill.
Senate Bill 925 requires medical staff bylaws at healthcare facility to provide fair hearing process to challenge denial, revocation, suspension, or restriction of physician privileges, and specifies the requirements for the process.
Okay. Very briefly. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, thank you for listening to us. I know this bill is going to be carried over tomorrow night, but obviously we have someone who's come from Southern Oregon just for today, not like me, and I'd like to have her testimony be heard, and then we can move on to the floor.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Dr. Catherine Lee Hilsinger. I'm a board-certified OBGYN, ex-chairman of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, ex-director of Public Health Department in Klamath County, and a frivolous lawsuit was filed against me, which was later dropped, and because of that, my insurer dropped me, and I could not find insurance. And I ended up going to a Class B insurance carrier. The reason why I say that is the Class A carriers justify for the rural health subsidy, but Class B carriers do not. And so I was given insurance for $300,000 for 1 year, 12 months of OB coverage, which did not include an extra $100,000 tail, which, of course, I don't make, and I could not afford. So I tried very hard to work with Merle West Medical Center Administration, which is the only hospital in our community, and they were not willing to help with the insurance coverage, and so I had to drop my obstetrical coverage. We are in desperate need of obstetricians in rural Oregon, as you know, and their response to the tort reform crisis was to tell me that if I didn't provide obstetrics, they would deny me hospital privileges for gynecology. So in essence, my whole livelihood was threatened. There was approximately 5 days where I had no insurance coverage, and during that time, the only other obstetrician in town was incapacitated with a headache, and the hospital then asked the general surgeons to perform cesarean sections, and I had told them, I'm in town, I'm willing to work, help me pay my insurance. They wouldn't do that. The net result was that the general surgeons were so angry at being asked to do that because, number one, they've never seen one, number two, they don't know how to do it, and they felt it was very bad medicine that they called the Oregon Medical Association to complain, and the whole medical community was an uproar over this hospital decision, and the OMA stepped in and helped me get insurance. So that was a crisis that was solved. Approximately 2 years later, I adopted a baby at the age of 44 and felt that I could no longer work the 65 to 100-hour week work that I was doing for that community. I've been there almost 12 years, and I chose to improve the quality of my life, have some balance, and not be a workaholic. So I asked to step down from obstetrics because I felt, as a single parent, it was not in my child's best interest for me to not be home. And they dropped my privileges again because if I didn't do obstetrics, they felt they would deny my GYN privileges. For a year and a half, I took no obstetrical patients myself and provide backup insurance for the family practice physicians, basically running in a crisis situation, which is stat C-section, people I've never met before, covering for the family practice physicians and the independent midwives in the community. And at this point, I just feel that I should be allowed to practice the way I want to practice, or they should be willing to pay for my insurance if they want insist on me being still in the medical community practicing a service that's needed, and they're not willing to negotiate at all. And so I just feel like I've been, I don't know, this is why this bill is here, because of people like me.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry that the rest of the committee wasn't here, but we will certainly take that into account and share that information. We'll tell them you don't have any written testimony, so I'll make sure that they listen to the recording so they hear your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and yes. What is your current status?
I have full privileges at the moment because I'm still practicing obstetrics.
Okay.
I have not personally taken any OB patients for a year and a half. I'm just practicing back at the community because I don't have any options outside of moving out of the state.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. I'm sorry that we have to rush, but we need
thank
to be on the
time.
Floor, and thank you. And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 925. And we will carry 925 and 924 and what else? And this one, if the amendments are ready.
Oh, that one we prefer Wednesday.
Okay. All right. And 153 goes to Wednesday, so carry that over to Wednesday. I'm still in committee. And then I want to make sure that we carry over, let's see, 924, 925, we passed that one out. So we've carried over all the ones that we need to carry over properly. All right. With that, we're adjourned.